Welcome to another episode of the Gay Bar Archive Show, where we explore gay history, one bar at a time. I'm your host, Art Smith, and joining us today is Linda Simpson. Since the 1980s, Linda Simpson has been a nightlife promoter, journalist, playwright, and game show hostess. Her slideshow presentation, The Drag Explosion, features her photos of New York City's drag scene in the 1980s and 90s. Welcome to the show, Linda.
Well, thank you, Art. Nice to be here.
It's nice to have you. I'm really excited to learn about the scene in New York City and particularly one club that you apparently are very familiar with, a club that's been operating for over 40 years on Avenue A, and that would be the Pyramid Club.
Yes. Yes.
A lot of people don't realize, you know, the Pyramid Club got started, like I said, over 40 years ago and has endured much longer than the bars everybody thinks of in New York, like Studio 54 and Limelight and all that. But it served a completely different clientele. You know, Limelight and Studio 54 were looking for the glitz and the glamour and the Hollywood. Tell us about what Pyramid Club is like.
Well, the Pyramid went through different phases, of course, over its 40-year history. And I think many people associate the Pyramid mostly with the 80s. And that's when the East Village was kind of a, you know, real hubbub of like kind of artistic avant-garde happenings. And the Pyramid, I think even before what we know it as of, was like kind of a working man's bar for like, I think like the Polish community that lived in the East Village. Anyways, around 1979, 1980, a couple of like hip people took it over and started catering to kind of like the arty, you know, bohemian community. And certainly it had like a queer edge. And many of the people that were involved behind the scenes and instrumental in the Pyramid were gay. And so it became like this, you know, center of frivolous and fun activity. And there was a stage. And so it was very theatrical, too, with a lot of shows going on. And as the years went by, it became more and more drag-centric. Drag had always played a part, but it became more draggy. And then kind of like with the late 80s, it sort of declined. A lot of the crowd had moved on, or, you know, the club also had been devastated by AIDS, like many of the spaces in New York City. And I came in around 1990 and started throwing a party. And I would say that was sort of another phase of the Pyramid that started then. And, you know, after I was gone, there was more.
Now, a while back, I interviewed someone from Atlanta who had moved to New York City and promoted some events in the club scene there. And understand he was involved also in the Pyramid Club. It was Larry T.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And I think at the time he was dating Lahoma and had moved there with RuPaul. Mm-hmm. And RuPaul had performed, I believe, his first New York City show at the Pyramid Club just a couple years after they opened in the early 80s.
Well, that certainly makes sense. I don't know exactly, but, you know, the Pyramid had that similar sensibility to that gang in Atlanta had, which was really silly and funny and campy. You know, you didn't have to be perfect on stage in order to be appreciated. And back then, let's remember, drag was pretty square. I mean, worldwide. And so the Pyramid was very unique in that they were doing kind of like, you know, almost like a punk rock version of drag, kind of reinventing the genre and sort of embracing drag when most other clubs and bars were kind of scorning it. So, and Rue, you know, certainly had the same sensibility as, and Larry and Lahoma certainly had the same sensibility as the Pyramid crowd.
Yeah, and the pyramid itself, if you look at their ads over the years and the decor of the bar, any photographs that you might stumble across of the pyramid, had that very kind of edgy, underground, avant-garde appearance. It wasn't trying to be, you know, the perfect design for an ad or the perfect logo or the perfect anything. They were just trying to have fun and to embrace that kind of struggling artist, actor, musician, bohemian crowd, as opposed to some of the other clubs that were trying to be more polished.
Well, exactly. I mean, part of it was the pyramid was kind of a dive bar. There was so much you could do with it. I mean, it was an old building and an old club itself. So, you know, you couldn't make it too fancy schmancy. Also, it was located on Avenue A. And back then, the East Village did have a very dangerous reputation, which was true. So, you know, to make it to the pyramid was kind of like, you know, an effort for a lot of people. And I think only the people that went to the pyramid really wanted to be there. It was very, very popular, though. And I've, you know, heard about this through people that worked back then and, you know, during the 80s. And, you know, I was going at that point. And they made a lot of money. So the pyramid, you know, was very profitable at some points, too, because it was such a hot spot. And so for the people that work there, it was a great way of, you know, not having to join 9 to 5 and be able to, you know, fulfill their working at a nightlife, a nightclub fantasy.
And another kind of historical item about the Pyramid Club is that in the mid-80s, I think it was 1985, another popular pyramid performer who is well-known around the world now, Lady Bunny, hosted the Wigstock Festival in New York City. And that kind of evolved out of some of the performers that were, you know, connected with the pyramid as well.
Yeah, definitely. For the first several years, Wigstock, which Wigstock was very like pyramid driven. And Wigstock for the first several years too was held in Tompkins Square Park, which was kitty corner to the pyramid. And as legend has it, Bunny and a few other people stumbled out drunk from the pyramid late one night and went over to the band shell. There used to be this old crumbling band shell in Tompkins Square Park. And I think they were just goofing around. And then they came up with the idea of doing kind of an outdoor drag fest called Wigstock, which of course was a parody of Woodstock, the old hippie fest. And so Bunny, you know, went with the idea. She went and got permits. And I know it was 85. Was that the first
Wigstock? I remember it being Labor Day weekend of 1985.
Okay, great. I wasn't there the first time. I was there for the second and probably everyone after that, except for maybe a couple of exceptions. But it was really fun and really unique because it was an outdoor daytime event. And, you know, you usually didn't see drag queens during the day. And it was a variety show with Bunny, who was very hysterical hosting. And I think, like I said, I think the pyramid kind of bankrolled the whole show for the first few years. And a lot of people would be like, you know, trekking back and forth from the park to the pyramid where they had dressing rooms. And it was, you know, it was a success. I mean, first few years, it was just kind of an insider-y crowd. But as the years progressed, it became bigger and bigger. I can't remember when I started. I joined the pyramid roster, but I can't remember when it was. Like late 80s or 90 maybe, but I think it was late 80s. Anyways, I started becoming one of the acts also.
I have to backtrack a couple minutes to something you said a few minutes ago, because I'm just dumbfounded. You said Lady Bunny stumbled out of the bar drunk? Lady Bunny is drunk?
I don't want to give away any secrets. Actually, Bunny doesn't drink anymore these days. So, you know. I mean, we all make changes in our lives.
Now, you know, as I started doing research about the pyramid, I'd heard about it. I've never been there, but I have heard about it in the course of my research. And I wanted to find out as much as I could about it. And there are a couple of little kind of mainstream facts that are associated with the pyramid that I did not know. Mm-hmm. The first one is that Andy Warhol and Debbie Harry dropped by the pyramid to do a feature on the club for MTV. Andy Warhol and Debbie Harry actually showed up at the pyramid and filmed a feature on the Pyramid Club.
Did they really?
Which kind of surprises me because, again, it's not the Limelight. It's not the Saint. It's not Studio 54. It's an kind of off the beaten path, you know, about as off Broadway as you can get.
This is true, but both Debbie and Andy would have been aware of the pyramid, certainly, because it was an avant-garde hotspot. And it was, back then, we depended on magazines and, other publications to find out about nightlife. Pyramid, of course, would have been listed, you know, and word of mouth would have gotten out, too, that this was a hot spot to go to. And, you know, Warhol was like, you know, a god. Debbie was a goddess for the pyramid crowd. So I'm sure they would have been, you know, welcomed with open arms.
Now, another fun fact I discovered was that Madonna appeared at her very first AIDS benefit at the pyramid.
Really? Well, Madonna's good friend was one of the managers of the club. I mean, I'm not going to be the best person to talk to about some of the early history because I don't know all the names of people that were behind the scenes. I mean, I know some people, but I didn't meet all of them. But Madonna was connected to the club because of her great friendship with one of the managers.
And of course, back at that time, she wasn't the international superstar she is now.
No. She was a struggling performer.
Right. But it's just interesting that a small bar that's been around for so long has had connections with different celebrities. I also heard that it was a favorite hangout for Keith Haring. That, you know,
I did. Yeah, I remember Keith. I remember seeing there. And I think it was a hangout for him.
And my research also indicates that both Nirvana and the Red Hot Chili Peppers played their very first New York City concerts at the Pyramid.
Well, I had heard that too. And that's one thing about the Pyramid also. It wasn't just like, you know, a queer dance party or, you know, queer performance space every night of the week. It did devote some of the nights to rock and roll. So there were quite a few bands and clubs that performed at the club. And so it had sort of, it depended on what night you went really to the pyramid in many ways and what the programming was.
I'm hoping that they're still open. My research indicates that they probably are. Their website is still active. And
well, maybe there was a big hullabaloo last year that it was closing. But then, like, you know, a few weeks later, I saw after that they were going to try to keep it open on some nights. So who knows? The ownership of the pyramid has changed over the years. But when I was doing a party there in 1990, the current ownership came on. And they still have it. And I don't know what their, you know, motives are exactly.
So speaking of your parties at the pyramid, had you been doing drag for a while before you decided to get into the party promoter business?
Not that much. I had been throwing parties because I had been publishing an underground magazine. And so it was called My Comrade. And I would do drag for the parties that we would throw for our release parties. But I hadn't really been doing drag that much before I kind of like dove headfirst into promoting and hosting a party. So I learned a lot. On the spot doing the party was called Channel 69.
That's a great name. So what were your parties about? What made your parties different from the parties that other promoters did or other clubs did? What was your little niche?
Well, what we were keeping alive, sort of the tradition of the, you know, the pyramid theatricality. So we had shows, drag shows, every week. Our party was on a Wednesday. And the pyramid had a dance floor too. So the DJ who worked with me, DJ Deanie Johnson, you know, would be in charge of that. And we would have go-go dancers on the bar, which was a pyramid tradition too. So we just kind of like, you know, kept waving the freak flag. But things by 1990 had, you know, were different than the 80s scene. And I think that we kind of ushered in sort of a new wave of drag. Some of the, you know, the old timers or the veterans like Bunny and Taboo and RuPaul, et cetera, were involved with Channel 69, but there were a lot of like newcomers too. And we had, you know, maybe a different aesthetic, different, a bit of a different sensibility than what had come before. But basically, you know, the bottom line was to make them laugh. You know, it was all about humor in many ways. I mean, some fierce performances also, but it was basically a comedy place.
Now, I've watched some video of your emceeing at Weekstock, and mm-hmm. I've seen a little bit of your drag persona.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have been performing at Wigstock since 1989. Thank you so much.
And why?
So,
and why?
And it's so great to see that the audience, after all these years, is still a bunch of alcoholic and stone perverts. Oh my God, Wigstock back in the day. I remember RuPaul was a struggling performer. I said, Ru, you've got to think outside of the box. I meant the cardboard box she was living in. Oh, and now Ru, of course, is a big TV star. I actually auditioned to be on Drag Race, but the producers said, no thanks, one old queen who can't sing is enough. Shut up. Ladies and gentlemen. Oh, come on. Singer RuPaul? That is like Demi Lovato, drug counselor. There's actually quite a few Drag Race performers here today, including, who's that one with the horrible music videos? Oh, I know, all of them. Oh, my goodness. Ladies and gentlemen, you should see it backstage here at Wigstock. There have not been so many hairless bodies squeezed together since that boys' soccer team in Thailand got stuck in a cave. Did anybody catch Darcelle X5 earlier up here on stage? She is the world's oldest drag queen. Hey, what does it taste like to go down on Darcelle X3? Depends.
How would you describe your style of drag to someone who has never seen you perform before?
Well, that's a good one. I don't know. I mean, you know, I'm of a certain age, so I guess I'm a little older. I mean, you could just start with that. But I mean, I've been told my humor can be a little dry. I mean, I try to be friendly and engaged and inviting with the audience. I'm an interactive drag queen in that I'm not I just don't confine myself to the stage. I often interact and drag with people, and I'm friendly and conversational. I guess I'm kind of a comedy queen in many ways. I'm not a musical act. That's one thing I'm not. I really never took up lip syncing or live singing. So I am more kind of a microphone queen in many ways.
I know when I've spoken to other performers in the past, they tell me that they were inspired by somebody. One of the first interviews I did was with Jimmy James, who obviously had his roots and his love for Marilyn Monroe and some of the other, you know, fabulous, glamorous women. Who was your inspiration for drag? Is there somebody in your head that you said, I want to be Joan Rivers, or I want to be, you know, somebody?
I don't think somebody that specific, but I had kind of a general blur of like people on TV like Mary Tyler Moore or Marlo Thomas that had played that girl, and just kind of like, you know, girls that had moved to the big city to make it big and were going to, you know, conquer the world by their wit, charm, and good looks. So that was kind of, you know, my inspiration.
What is your favorite story of something that happened to you at the pyramid?
Oh my God, I'm so bad at this, remembering specific incidences, because in general, it was just very fun. I think one thing that sticks out for me is that the Pyramid Club had a rather sizable dressing room. And the stage was on the ground floor of the pyramid. The pyramid also had a basement. And so the dressing room was in the basement, right underneath the stage. And you would get up to the stage via a ladder. And, you know, back then, it was when we were young, I guess it wasn't that big a deal to climb it in heels. I don't know if I could do it so easily now. But just in general, my favorite times were just kind of conversing and, you know, gossiping and hanging out in the dressing room with either cast members from that night show or, you know, off-duty drag queens or, so, you know, nightlife VIPs that would come back in and chat. It was, you know, there was no doorman or anything to the dressing room, but it was kind of a confined area. And it was, you know, my kind of like office for the time that I threw Channel 69. And so I have it was, you know, the hubbub of the club for me. I mean, I would, you know, spend time on stage and I would mix and mingle with the crowd. But the dressing room, I guess, was my, you know, special area.
How long did your parties go on there? You started in the early 90s promoting there. How long?
I was there from 90, the Channel 69, the party I threw was from 90 to 92. So not an incredibly long time, but it made an impact. And then I was back at the Pyramid over the course of the next several years, throwing a party here or there, like a, you know, one-nighter or something like that.
So my whole project is all about preserving the memories of gay bars that have made an impact on people over the decades, mm-hmm. and spreading the stories for people who were there, as well as people who never knew about these places, and just kind of putting it in the history books. And you did something without even thinking about it or knowing about it back in the 80s and 90s that makes a job for me a little bit easier. So many people, when they went out to the clubs back then, you didn't have everything documented. It was not necessarily cool to walk into a gay bar with a camera. And if you did, because, you know, film was precious and lighting wasn't great and so on, there are not a whole lot of photographs of the gay bar scene from back in the day. But yet, for some reason, you felt inspired once you, you know, went into the Pyramid and other clubs back then to photograph it and to keep the photographs for all these years. What inspired that? What made you think you should walk in there like a, you know, a tourist with a camera and take pictures of everybody?
Well, I'm not quite sure, but I wasn't a tourist. It was part of my inner circle and my life. And so I guess I just wanted to document it because I felt close to it, but I didn't really have any ulterior motive. I think a little bit of it was I was a little shy. So it was a way of easily communicating with people, taking photos and getting, you know, being interactive with people. But I really didn't have any deep reasoning for taking the photos. And certainly it wasn't to document the era or anything. It was mostly just, I recognized that I knew a lot of fun people who looked great and were having a great time. And so I randomly took photos of them. I didn't always bring my camera. There were a lot of things I didn't take photos of, but sometimes I did. And so I did amass, you know, a collection of photos over the years of those those formative drag years of mine from like the late 80s to the mid 90s, especially.
So, as a guess, how many photographs do you think you took of that scene?
Thousands, but not all of them are good. You know, I mean, a lot of them are like, you know, shitty photos. But there were some good ones too. I got some great photos that are, you know, iconic even of that era. So I was lucky, you know. I don't consider myself like a, you know, top-notch photographer who knows technical stuff about cameras or anything, but I guess I had a bit of an eye, and I was able to get some good photos of some, you know, great people.
And you, at some point in the not too distant past, decided that it would be a good idea to take that massive collection of photographs and cull through it and pull out some of your favorites and some of the ones that expressed the whole feeling of the drag scene from back in the 80s and 90s, and to put them into a slideshow and into a book, both of which are called The Drag Explosion.
Yes, that's right.
Which came first?
On the slideshow. The slideshow I've been doing probably for like 6 or 7 years. And as you mentioned, it's, you know, kind of, I don't know, the best of the best, but certainly a lot of the good photos that I took. They tell the history of the era. It's a narrated slideshow. It's done to music. And it's divided into sections like nightlife or the Pyramid Club, et cetera. And it just talks about like how drag, you know, miraculously transformed during that time from an underground art form into this mainstream sensation. And there's an arc too. It was, you know, a scene that eventually imploded, but it did cause, like, you know, certainly a major impact on my life, at least, and on many others. And I think that people find it interesting. It's only like 40 minutes, so it's not like you have to sit through a, you know, 10-hour lecture. And then a book came out last year, as you mentioned, a hardcover book. I happen to have a copy here. And 250 pages. And it's from Domain Books. And the guy who runs Domain Books, whose name is David Knowles, also art directed it. And he did a great, great job. I'm really happy and proud of the book. And so I've been, parlaying my photos into different projects. And they've been well received. So I'm very happy about that.
Well, we're certainly glad that you did that, because, as I said, that's part of our history that is kind of missing. There are not thousands of photographs out there from the 80s and 90s underground club scene to, you know, there's a few exceptions. I know you're in New York City, correct?
Yes.
And I know you know Michael Fazakerly.
Because
he actually photographed you.
Michael, yes, I think Michael's photos are mostly studio photos, but Michael certainly captured that scene very well.
And that was a different side of the scene. He was more, from what I've seen, he was more focused in the kind of Michael Alec, James St. James.
Yeah, he certainly documented the club kid scene extensively.
Quite a bit. And I think they also had a whole collection of male physiques as well from that period.
Michael took a lot of pictures of the Go-Go Boys too.
But yours is kind of a more earthy, gritty, you know, not...
Yeah, mine are kind of like, you know, on the scene or behind the scenes. And as you mentioned, you know, it wasn't very common for people to carry around cameras back then. And a lot of, you know, gay spaces did not want cameras back then also. But I wasn't like a paparazzi type photographer, just like running up to anybody and snapping their photo. I mostly took photos of my friends, like, you know, 99% of the people in the book who appear, I knew from the club scene. So, and some are really good friends too. So I wasn't, I don't think that I was like, you know, violating anyone's privacy too much, but I was discreet. I knew when not to take photos. And that's why I didn't. And like I mentioned, my photo taking was random. I mean, I wish I had taken more pictures, honestly. Probably everybody does from that era. But I did. I'm glad that at least the ones I got have been, you know, put together in this book that, you know, anybody can see.
Absolutely, because that's so important to be able to, you know, document all this. And now that we actually have places to keep them, you know, back in 1980, there were virtually no gay archives anywhere. Now every city has one. There's several national ones that have thousands of books and documents collected to preserve our gay history. But 30 or 40 years ago, that didn't exist either. So yeah. Now, not only is there a book that you've produced, but it's going to end up, if it hasn't already, in several archives that will keep it there for generations. So it's not going to be lost somewhere, you know, on your bookshelf at home.
Let's hope. Thank you, Art, for your optimism.
Well, you know, I had noticed I started a group for this project on Facebook, which is called Gay Bar Archives. And that group is just barely a year old. It's maybe 12 or about 13, 14 months old. And we're at about 3,800 members.
Wow.
And without any kind of external promotion, I don't pay for ads on Facebook. So that tells me that there are at least 3,800 people who have enough of an interest in gay bar history to want to join and exchange information. And that number is growing every day. So I have confidence that as our world kind of expands a little bit and we have more archives and we have more gay filmmakers and we have gay networks, we have gay streaming networks like Reverie, all those things are going to work together to help us preserve our history and make it available to the next generations that come after us.
Well, I mean, you know as well as I do that gay bars and clubs are such a vital part of, you know, LGBT history and culture, that it really is a very, you know, vital pursuit. And I think I'm not surprised that there are so many people interested in what you're doing.
Yeah, and you know, you've been in the scene for a while. Do you still perform in bars in New York City?
I do. I'm a bingo queen. I host bingo and I have for many years now. And it's funny, I mostly probably do it for straight audiences now, but I do make my living as a bingo queen. During COVID, I segued into online stuff also. So right now, you know, in this current era, I'm doing kind of a hybrid of live and virtual. I enjoy it. I'm a game show hostess. I really like it. And it's expanded my crowd. And also, it's more adult hours for me now. I mean, I don't think I'd really want to. I don't think I find it as appealing at these days to work at the nightclubs, which are often, you know, late night. And, you know, nothing wrong with that. And I certainly enjoyed those moments. But it doesn't appeal to me as much now.
So you were associated with or familiar with a number of performers who have kind of skyrocketed to national or international notoriety over the decades, several of which were associated with the Pyramid Club, like RuPaul and Lady Bunny. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that transition? You know, do you kind of wish that they had stayed in the underground scene and continued contributing for 30 or 40 years? Or are you really happy that someone like RuPaul is now the face of drag around the world?
Oh, well, I mean, I'm you know, happy for Ru. I think that's what you wanted. I mean, I know that's what you wanted, was mainstream acceptance and fame. She made no secret of that, even when she was a struggling queen. So I think it's all good. I think if, you know, Ru certainly has, you know, taken the baton and run forward with it. And, you know, RuPaul's Drag Race is, you know, the conversation topic about anything drag these days. So, you know, good for her for, you know, making such an impact on drag culture and society at large. I think back when we were all doing drag, Bunny and Rue were probably about the only two people, maybe with the exception of Lip Synca, who even really thought about careers beyond what we were doing in the nightlife. I mean, drag is much more careerist nowadays, where queens are thinking, oh, you know, I can get this job and become a, you know, internet sensation or a nightclub, you know, celebrity or nightlife celebrity, etc. Back then, we were just kind of like focused on having fun and you know, playing at the clubs and you know, messing around. And it was more kind of a little bit emphasis on, I don't know, what was the emphasis on? Just, you know, being existing as opposed to, you know, trying to figure out how far we could go in showbiz.
So you were kind of hoping to be a big fish in that small pond of, you know, the underground nightlife, as opposed to being a big fish on the international stage. You wanted to be known and accepted and appreciated in the Pyramid Club or in that crowd.
Yes. I mean, I'm not going to say that I didn't have, you know what I mean, dreams and aspirations to become famous like everybody, but I wasn't, you know, seriously pursuing that. In the early 90s or, you know, around 92, like when Rue became famous with her hit single Supermodel, there was a lot of attention paid then to the downtown drag scene because the media was curious as to, you know, where Rue had come from. And during that time, I did gain, you know, mild fame as a cable talk show hostess. So this is on Manhattan Cable. And I was a writer for magazines. And so, you know, in a way, I did get a taste of success, you know, as a drag queen. But there really still at that time, there wasn't a lot of places that you could take it. I mean, Rue was really the only one that kind of emerged from that scene as sort of a big star, and rightly so. I mean, she, you know, certainly had the chops. And after a while, the media interest did fade. I mean, and so the powers that be kind of like, you know, said, forget about this drag trend. So that kind of really, you know, put the end to that particular drag explosion also.
I know Rue from my experience. I lived in Atlanta at the time that Rue was performing in Atlanta.
Oh, really? And,
Rue's favorite club in Atlanta, there were, I guess, two of them that he used to be seen at. One was the Celebrity Club, which was over on Ponce de Leon. And my understanding is that was also the name that Larry T and RuPaul used at another club in New York City, the Celebrity Club.
Yeah.
It has a lot of parallels to the pyramid scene. It was a narrow, dark, funky kind of not dive bar kind of atmosphere. And RuPaul and Lahoma, I remember fondly walking down the street in Midtown, and they would take a sheet of paper and a black magic marker, and they would handwrite a poster, a flyer, and then they would go to, like, I think it was Kinko's had opened up, and they would print like 50 copies and staple them to the telephone poles on colored paper. And it would always say something outrageous, like world famous RuPaul and Lahoma performing tonight at Weekends. And Weekends was a 24-hour nightclub. They serve liquor around the clock. And so RuPaul would get on stage, which was basically the stage. There was probably a 3-foot cube of plywood that was painted black, and get up there in a pair of Daisy Dukes and a cutoff t-shirt and be basically a go-go boy. He wasn't really in full drag at that time. And he used to promote himself like he was, you know, Elvis Presley coming to perform or something, that he was the biggest performer on the planet. And he made quite a name for himself in Atlanta by being so kind of cocky and, you know, having that, at least appearing to have that big ego that he was so great that everybody should just come and watch wherever he was going to be. And then, of course, a few years later, they packed up a little minivan and drove up to New York City and you know, the rest is history.
Right. Yeah. Well, we was doing that in New York too. I mean, often, I remember the, you know, putting up flyers and stuff like that on the local, you know, telephone poles, etc. But yeah, I mean, some of it, I think, was tongue in cheek, the hype that Rue was making about himself. But at the same time, it was a way of gaining interest from people. Also, it's kind of like, you know, if you tell yourself enough or other people enough that you're the greatest, people start believing it. So, you know, there was logic in the whole PR effort also.
I think that has some parallels to the club kid scene too, because the same thing is basically true of Michael Elligan, James St. James. They were not anybody particularly famous when they started their club kid parties. And I think the same thing is probably true. Johnny McGovern was another one that promoted some kind of edgy underground club scenes in New York City. And he wasn't particularly well known at that time either. But because they had that outgoing personality and that confidence in what they were doing and were willing to go out there and put themselves on the line and say, we're going to do this. And it all contributed to what we have now.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's showbiz. That's nightlife. You have to be a little brash. You have to sell yourself. Sometimes you can be a little more, you know, modest or natural about it. But often to, you know, make yourself known, you know, to cut through the noise, you do have to kind of, you know, explode fireworks whenever your name is mentioned.
And of course, the group of people you're talking about, these performers, are not what we would today label as mainstream drag performers, or even then for that matter. You know, that I would say someone like Chad Michaels is what you would consider a mainstream drag performer, or Frank Marino, or some of these people who put on the elegance and the, you know, they're trying to create the illusion of some celebrity or some, you know, real woman somewhere. But in your scene, these people were a lot more artsy and avant-garde. They were trying to be, you know, more fabulous and flamboyant and different than what you would see walking through a suburban mall.
Right. I think that what we were really trying to emphasize was our individualistic selves. So I think that people, you know, of the generation that I grew up with in drag weren't that into, I mean, you know, I mean, to do a celebrity impersonation was fine, but that wasn't your only, you know, calling card. You wanted to do more, and often it was done tongue in cheek. In fact, it was sort of a rebellion of that kind of drag stereotype that where you only do sort of female impersonation. So I think that sort of the role models for me, at least, were, you know, the Warhol superstars and Divine, people like that, that had really, like, you know, carved out very, you know, very vivid personalities. And that's what they were best known for, is just for being themselves as opposed to their performance skills or their impersonation skills.
And today, you know, we have a word for that. Back then, there was no real word to describe expressing your, you know, your true personality or who you felt you were inside. But today, you know, we have this authentic self concept that so many people, the whole gender identity discussion is about the same kind of thing, that if you happen to be born and designated male, that you should be able to wear eyeliner or have whatever, you know, outfit. If you want to wear a sparkly dress to the prom, or if you want, whatever you, however you want to express yourself should be acceptable in public. And you were doing that 30 or 40 years ago with the way you were expressing yourself in the bar. You weren't trying to be, you know, Dolly Parton. You were trying to be an interesting character that expressed your personality.
Yeah. I think you're right. I think, I mean, I don't know if we were I mean, I can't speak for everybody, but again, just speaking for myself, I mean, I wasn't trying to, you know, make a radical statement or, you know, some kind of, you know, big deal about gender expression. It just seemed kind of like a natural extension to dress in women's clothing and put on a wig and have fun. And I wasn't even creating a persona in that I was trying to think of a biography for them or change my voice or, you know, anything that dramatic. It was just sort of like a fun thing to do. I mean, I'm sure there's probably deeper psychological issues than that. And I mean, I'm not totally unaware of some of them, but it was mostly just, I think, about having fun, kind of organic fun for me and many of my, you know, drag sisters. We just were having a good time and it was escapism in some regards, but it was I think, kind of a healthy way to do it.
And we're so glad that you did, because it opened so many doors for the gay world in general. Just having people that were, you know, being a little extravagant and expressing themselves the way that you did and the way the other performers at the Pyramid and other clubs did, it kind of opened the doors, you know, for everyone to step outside their comfort zone a little bit, whether that means, you know, that suddenly some guy that has always felt like he had to be super macho could wear a pink shirt with ruffles on it one day. Mm-hmm. Whatever the small or big step they took, it was all because there were public people in their, you know, in the entertainment scene, in the nightlife environment that took it beyond that. And they started to see, yeah, I can step a little bit further out. I can wear something a little flashier. I can be a little bit more flamboyant with my hairstyle. I can color my hair. Now you see 80-year-old women with purple hair that are part of the mainstream community because of, you know, the effects of the scene that you were involved in 30 or 40 years ago.
Those 80-year-old women better thank me then. No, I'm just kidding.
I'll give you your address.
Well, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, we helped pave the way for more, you know, different types of expression, just like the people that came before us were more kind of on that, you know, radical edge, paved the way for us. So it's a continuum.
So you were saying earlier that you were involved with Weekstock most of the years that Weekstock has occurred. Is Weekstock still going on?
Not on a regular basis. I mean, Bunny did revive it a few years ago, and it was made into an HBO documentary called Wig, but it's not being produced on an annual basis like it used to be.
Do you miss it?
Oh, yeah, it was fun. I mean, I mean, never say never. I wouldn't be surprised if there was another Wigstock or two or three or four or five, whatever. But yeah, no, it was fun. It was a great way of, you know, not just seeing acts, but a great way of getting together with a lot of people. I mean, I like the backstage action and seeing a lot of queens that I wouldn't normally get to see very often, or meeting new ones also.
Very cool. So you've been doing drag for a little while. You've been in the entertainment scene for a while. What do you see in the future? Do you see a day when you're going to hang up the wig and call it quits, or is this something that is always going to be a part of your life?
I'm not sure. I mean, we'll have to see how things go. I mean, I would assume that I would keep doing drag for as long as I was physically able to. I, you know, Linda Simpson is, you know, part of me. It's not just an act that I can hang up real easily. So I think I'll probably just keep going and going until, like I said, I finally, you know, collapse. But also, like, this is my, you know, it's my profession. So, you know, I in some ways need to do drag to pay the rent, et cetera, because I don't really have much else to fall back on. So, you won't be, this isn't the last you'll be seeing a Linda Simpson.
Awesome. And we certainly hope that you have great success with the book. And, you know, who knows? Maybe that'll grow into something bigger, too. Maybe there'll be a little documentary film made or something that talks about your memories from the club scene in New York City and the photographs that you've taken, the experiences you've had.
So, yes, let's hope. Let's hope I'm more a feature film with some young, beautiful star portraying me.
Well, of course. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to walk down memory lane with us and share some of your stories about your gay bar scene in New York City and about your book. Thank you.
My pleasure, Art. And I admire what you're doing. So keep up the good work.
Thank you. That concludes another episode of the Gay Bar Archive Show. For more information about this episode, or to find more episodes, visit GayBarArchives.com.